she'd know what to do. How prepared she thought she'd be. Magazines, websites, videos, advice from her OBGYN, stories from other mothers. But none of this is available to her now. None. She's not going to give birth in a hospital. It's going to happen right here in this house. In one of the rooms of this house. And the most she can expect is Tom assisting while Olympia holds her hand and looks on in horror. Blankets will be covering the windows. Maybe a t-shirt will be under her ass. She'll drink from a glass of murky well water. And that's it. That's how it's going to happen. She shifts onto her back again. Breathing hard and slow, she stares at the ceiling. She closes her eyes, then opens them again. Can she do this? Can she? She has to. And so she repeats mantras, words to get her ready. In the end, it doesn't matter if it happens in a hospital or on the kitchen floor. Your body knows what to do. Your body knows what to do. Your body knows what to do. The baby-to-be is all and everything that matters. Abruptly, as if they're imitating the sound of the baby Mallory prepares for, she hears the birds cooing outside the front door. She withdraws from her thoughts and turns toward the sound. As she slowly sits up in bed, she hears a knock come from the front door. She freezes. Was that the door? Is it Tom? Did somebody go outside? She hears it again, and amazed, she sits up. She places a hand on her belly and listens. It comes again. Mallory slowly swings her feet to the floor and rises before crossing the room. She stops at the door, one hand on her belly, one on the wood of the frame, and listens. Another knock. This time it's louder. She walks to the head of the stairs and stops again. Who is it? Beneath her pajamas, her body feels cold. The baby moves. Mallory feels a little faint. The birds are still making noise. Is it one of the housemates? She re-enters her bedroom and grabs a flashlight. She walks to Olympia's room and shines the beam on her bed. She is sleeping. In the room at the end of the hall, she sees Cheryl on the bed. Mallory walks slowly down the stairs to the living room. Tom. Tom is asleep on the carpet. Felix is on the couch. Tom, Mallory says, touching his shoulder. Tom, wake up. Tom rolls to his stomach. Then he looks up, suddenly, at Mallory. Tom, she says.
Is everything okay?
Someone is knocking at the front door.
What? Now?
Right now. Another knock comes. Tom turns his face toward the hall.
Holy shit. What time is it?
I don't know. Late.
Okay.
Tom gets up quickly. He pauses, as if attempting to wake up entirely, leaving his sleep on the floor. He is fully clothed. Beside where he was sleeping, Mallory sees the crude beginnings of another helmet. Tom turns on the living room lamp. Then the two are walking toward the front door. They pause in the hall. Another series of knocks come.
Hello,
a man says. Mallory grabs Tom's arm. Tom turns on the hall light.
Hello,
the man says again. More knocks follow.
I need to be let in, the man says. I have nowhere else to go. Hello?
Finally, Tom steps toward the door. From the end of the hall, Mallory sees a shape move. It is Don.
What's going on?
He asks.
Someone is at the door, Tom says.
Don, hardly awake, looks confused. Then he snaps.
Well, what are you going to do about it? More knocks.
I need a place to go, the voice says. I can't handle being alone out here anymore.
I'm going to talk to him, Tom says. We're not a fucking hostel, Tom,
Don says.
I'm just going to talk to him.
Then Don is walking toward them. Mallory hears shuffling from upstairs.
If anyone is there, I could... Who are you?
Tom finally calls. There is a moment of silence. Then,
oh, thank God someone is there. My name is Gary. He could be bad, Don says. He could be mad.
Felix and Cheryl appear at the end of the hall. They look exhausted. Jules is here now, too. The dogs are behind him.
What's going on, Tom? Hey, Gary, Tom says. Tell us a little more about yourself.
The birds are cooing.
Who is this?
Felix asks.
My name is Gary, and I'm 46 years old. I have a brown beard. I haven't opened my eyes in a long time.
I don't like the sound of his voice, Cheryl says. Olympia is here now. Tom calls,
Why are you outside?
Gary says,
I had to leave the house I was staying in. The people there were no good. A situation arose. What the hell does that mean?
Don calls. Gary pauses. Then,
they got violent. That's not good enough.
Don says to the others, Don't open this door.
Gary,
Tom calls.
How long have you been out there? 2 days, I think. Could be closer to three.
Where have you been staying?
Staying? On lawns? Beneath bushes?
Fuck, Cheryl says.
Listen, Gary says. I'm hungry. I'm alone and I'm very afraid. I understand your caution, but I've got nowhere else to go.
You've tried other houses? Tom says.
Yes, I've been knocking on doors for hours. You are the first to answer.
How did he know we were here? Mallory asks the others.
Maybe he didn't, Tom says.
He knocked for a long time. He knew we were here. Tom turns to Don. His expression is asking Don what he thinks.
No way.
Tom is sweating now.
I'm sure you want to.
Don continues angrily. You're hoping he has information.
That's right,
Tom says. I am hoping he has ideas. I'm also thinking he needs our help.
Right. Well, I'm thinking there could be 7 men out there ready to slit all our throats.
God, Olympia says. Jules and I were out there 2 days ago, Tom says.
He's right that the other houses are empty. So why doesn't he sleep in one of those?
I don't know, Don. Food?
And you guys were outside at the same time. And he didn't hear you?
Damn it, Tom says. I have no idea how to answer that. He could have been a street over.
You guys didn't try those houses. How do you know he's telling the truth?
Let him in, Jules says. Don faces him.
That's not how it works in here, man.
Then let's vote.
Come the fuck on,
Don says, fuming.
If one of us doesn't want to open the fucking door, we shouldn't open the fucking door.
Mallory thinks of the man on the porch. In her imagination, his eyes are closed. He is trembling. The birds still coo.
Hello,
Gary says again. He sounds strained, impatient.
Yeah, Tom says. I'm sorry, Gary. We're still talking this over.
Then he turns to the others.
Vote, he says.
Yes, Felix says. Jules nods. I'm sorry, Cheryl says. No. Tom looks to Olympia. She shakes her head no.
I hate to do this to you, Mallory, he says, but it's a tie. What are we going to do?
Mallory doesn't want to answer. She doesn't want this power. this stranger's fate has been dumped at her feet.
Maybe he needs help, she says.
Yet the moment after saying it, she wishes she hadn't. Tom turns to the door. Don reaches across and grabs his wrist.
I don't want that door opened, he hisses.
Don, Tom says, slowly pulling his wrist from Don's hand. We voted. We're going to let him in, just like we let Olympia and Mallory in, just like George let you and me in.
Don stares at Tom for what feels to Mallory like a very long time.
Will it come to blows this time?
Listen to me, Don says. If something bad comes from this, if my life is put in danger because of a fucking vote, I'm not going to stop to help you guys on my way out of this house.
Don, Tom says.
Hello,
Gary calls.
Keep your eyes closed, Tom yells. We're letting you in.
Tom's hand is on the doorknob. Jules, Felix, Tom says, use the broomsticks. Cheryl, Mallory, you'll need to get up close to him. Feel him. Okay? Now, everybody close your eyes.
In the darkness, Mallory hears the door open. There is silence. Then Gary speaks.
Is the door open?
He says eagerly.
Hurry,
Tom says. Mallory hears shuffling. The front door closes. She steps forward.
Keep your eyes closed, Gary, she says.
She reaches for him, finds him, and brings her fingers to his face. She feels his nose, his cheeks, the sockets of his eyes. She touches his shoulders and asks for one of his hands.
This is new to me, he says. What are you searching?
Shh! She feels his hands and counts his fingers. She feels the fingernails and the light hair on the knuckles.
Okay, Felix says. I think he's alone.
Yes, Jules says. He's alone.
Mallory opens her eyes. She sees a man, much older than herself, with a brown beard and a tweed blazer over a black sweater. He smells like he's been outside for weeks.
Thank you,
he says, breathless. At first, nobody responds. They only watch him. His brown hair, combed over to the side, is unruly. He is both older and heavier set than any of the housemates. In his hand is a brown briefcase.
What's in there? Don asks.
Gary looks to the case as though he's forgotten he carried it.
My things, he says. What things I grabbed on my way out. What things?
Don asks. Gary, looking both surprised and sympathetic, opens the case. He turns it toward the housemates. Papers, a toothbrush, a shirt, a watch. Don nods. As Gary closes the case, he notices Mallory's belly.
Oh my, he says. You're close, aren't you?
Yes, she says coolly, not knowing yet if they can trust this man.
What are the birds for?
He asks.
Warning, Tom says.
Of course, Gary says.
Canaries in the mines. That's very clever of you. I heard them as I approached.
Then Tom invites Gary farther into the house. The dogs smell him. In the living room, Tom points to the easy chair.
You can sleep there tonight, he says. It reclines. Do you need something to eat?
Yes,
Gary says, relieved. Tom leads him through the kitchen and into the dining room.
We keep the canned goods in the cellar. I'll get you something.
Tom quietly motions for Mallory to follow him into the kitchen. She does.
I'm going to stay awake with him for a while, Tom says. Get some sleep if you want to. Everybody's exhausted. It's okay. I'll get him some food, some water, and we'll talk to him tomorrow. All of us.
There's no way I'm going to bed right now, Mallory says. Tom smiles, tired.
Okay.
He heads for the cellar. Mallory joins the others in the dining room. When Tom returns, he brings canned peaches.
I never would have thought, Gary says, that one day the world's most valuable tool would be a can opener.
Everybody is at the dining room table together. Tom asks Gary questions. How did he survive out there? Where did he sleep? It's clear that Gary is exhausted. Eventually, one by one, and beginning with Dawn, the housemates go to their bedrooms. As Tom walks Gary back into the living room, Mallory and Olympia rise from the table. On the stairs, Olympia puts her hand over Mallory's.
Mallory, she says, do you mind if I sleep with you tonight?
Mallory turns to her.
No,
she says.
I don't mind at all.
28. It is the next morning. Mallory gets up and gets dressed. It sounds like everyone is downstairs.
Did you have electricity as well?
Felix is asking as Mallory enters the living room. Gary is sitting on the couch. Seeing Mallory, he smiles.
This, Gary says, fanning a hand toward her, is the angel who felt my features when I entered. I have to admit, the human contact nearly made me cry.
Mallory thinks Gary talks a little like an actor. Theatrical flourishes.
And so did a vote really decide my fate?
Gary asks.
Yes, Tom says.
Gary nods.
In the house I came from, no such courtesies were extended. If somebody had an idea, they went with it, rather vigorously, whether or not everybody approved. It's refreshing to meet people who have retained some of the civility of our former lives.
I voted against it, Dawn says abruptly.
Did you?
Gary asks.
Yes, I did. 7 people under one roof is enough. I understand.
One of the huskies gets up and goes to Gary. Gary rubs the fur behind its ears. Tom begins explaining to him the same things he once explained to Mallory. Hydroelectricity. The supplies in the cellar. The lack of a phone book. How George died. After a while, Gary begins talking about a former housemate of his. A troubled man who didn't believe the creatures were harmful at all.
He believed that the people's reaction to them was psychosomatic. In other words, all this insanity fuss isn't caused by the creatures at all, but rather by the dramatic people who see them.
Insanity fuss, Mallory thinks. Do these 2 dismissive words belong to Gary's former housemate? Or are they Gary's?
I'd like to tell you guys about my experience at my former place,
Gary continues,
but I warn you, it's a dark one.
Mallory wants to hear this. They all do. Gary runs his fingers through his hair, then he begins.
There was no ad that we answered, and we weren't as young as you all. We had no communal sensibility, no group effort. My brother Duncan has a friend who took the Russia report very seriously. He was one of the early believers. It went well with his conspiracy theories and paranoia that the government or somebody is out to get us all. As goes myself, I still have moments where I can't believe it's happening. And who can blame me? I'm over 40 years old. So used to the life I was living, I never fathomed one like this. I resisted it. But Kirk, my brother's friend, was certain of it from the very start. And nothing, it seemed, would sway him. One afternoon, Duncan called and told me Kirk suggested we gather at his place for a few days, or until we learned more about this thing. What thing? I asked. Gary, it's all over the television. What thing, Duncan? The thing that happened in Russia? You can't be serious. Come on, Duncan said. We'll throw back some beers, eat some pizza, and humor him. You've got nothing to lose. I told him, no thank you. Hanging out with Crazy Kirk as he analyzed sensational stories didn't sound like a good time to me. But I showed up soon enough. I heard the reports just like everybody in the country did. They started to worry me. There were just so many of them. Still, I foolishly attempted to maintain my disbelief. These kinds of things just don't happen. But then came a report that forced me to take action. It was the one about the sisters in Alaska. You might be wondering why it took me so long to be convinced. Alaska was relatively late. But Alaska was also an American report, and I'm just provincial enough not to worry until it happens close to home. Even the reporter was clearly scared of what he was saying. Yes, even the man delivering the news did so, trembling. You know the story. A woman saw her two elderly neighbors, sisters, leaving the house. She assumed they had gone for their daily walk. 3 hours later, she heard on the radio that the sisters were in front of the hospital, crouched on the stone steps, trying to bite people as they passed. The woman drove to the hospital, fancying herself closer to the sisters than anyone else and likely able to help. But that wasn't the case. And the photos on CNN showed the woman with her face removed, literally on the sidewalk beside her bloody skull. Beyond her were the two old ladies, dead, shot by the police. That image chilled me. Such normal people, such everyday environs. For Kirk, the Alaskan incident validated all paranoid fantasies. Despite my own growing fear, I wasn't ready to exchange the life I'd known for this new, militia-like existence he was espousing. I was prepared to drape the windows, lock the doors, and hide. But Kirk was already coming up with plans to combat what he believed was an invasion. Whether that be alien or otherwise was never clear. He talked about weapons, gear, and guns like a veteran soldier. Of course, he wasn't one. He'd never enlisted in anything in his life. Gary pauses. He seems to ponder. Soon the house was crowded with quasi-militant males. Kirk was enjoying his newfound position of general, and I watched a lot of the buffoonery from the sidelines. I made a habit of letting Duncan know he ought to keep his distance. A man like Kirk was liable to send his friends into harm's way. The man grew increasingly contentious, juiced with the fantasy of overthrowing the villains of Kirk's invasion. Days passed, and yet nothing came of their boisterous claims that they would protect the city, eliminate the cause of this global madness, and secure their place in history as the band who fixed the big problem. Yet there was one man in the house who took action for what he believed. His name was Frank, and Frank believed that the creatures Kirk prepared for were no threat at all. Still, he came to the house, fearful, he admitted, of the inevitable lawlessness that would sweep the country. As Kirk planned useless daily drills, Frank became something of a shut-in, hardly leaving the bedroom on the second floor. And in there, he wrote. Day and night, Frank wrote with pencil, pen, marker, and makeup. One day, walking the upstairs hall, I heard something behind his closed door. It was a furious sound, laborious, angry, unflagging in its pace. I eased the door open a crack and saw him hunched over a desk, whispering about the cultish, overreactive society he loathed as he scribbled. I had no way of knowing what he was writing, but I wanted to find out. I talked to Duncan about it. My brother's face was painted with ridiculous camouflage. By then, he was truly infected with Kirk's ravings. He didn't believe Frank was a threat.
Frank, who bugled phrases like mass hysteria and psychosomatic idolatry, as Kirk and the others pantomimed target practice, weaponless, in the basement. Everyone dismissed Frank as a useless pacifist. Gary runs his hands through his hair again. I set out to find out what Frank was up to in his room. I began looking for an opportunity to read his secret writings. What do you think would happen to a man who is already mad if he were to see the creatures outside? Do you think he'd be impervious to it? His mind already fractured? Or do you suppose his madness would reach another, higher echelon of insane? Perhaps the mentally ill will inherit this new world, unable to be broken any more than they already are. I don't know any better than you do. Gary sips from a glass of water. My moment presented itself in this way. Kirk and the others were occupied in the basement. Frank was in the bath. I made my decision to snoop quickly. I entered his room and found his writings in the desk drawer. This was no little feat, as by then I was frightened of the man. The others may have dismissed him, found him laughable, but I suspected more brutish possibilities therein. I began reading. Soon I was overwhelmed with his words. No matter how long ago Frank had begun writing, it seemed impossible that he had already written this much. Dozens of notebooks, all in various colors, each more angry than the last. Tiny cursive couplets were followed by giant highlighted phrases, all declaring that the creatures were not to be feared. He referred to the rest of us as those with small minds who needed to be exterminated. He was dangerous indeed. Suddenly, hearing him rise from the bath, I hurried out of his room. Maybe Duncan wasn't so wrong to fall in with Kirk. Those notebooks showed me there were much worse reactions to this new world than his. Gary breathes deep. He wipes his lips with the back of his hand. When we woke up the next day, the drapes had been pulled down.
Cheryl gasps.
The doors were unlocked.
Don starts to say something.
And Frank was gone. He'd taken the notebook with him.
Oh, fuck, Felix says. Gary nods.
Was anybody hurt? Tom asks.
Gary's eyes grow watery, but he maintains himself.
No, he says. Nobody. Which I'm sure Frank would have included in his notes.
Mallory brings a hand to her belly.
Why did you leave?
Don asks impatiently.
I left, Gary says, because Kirk and the others talked at great length of tracking Frank down. They wanted to kill him for what he had done.
The room is quiet.
I knew then I had to get out. That house was ruined, plagued. Yours, it seems, is not. For this, Gary says, looking at Mallory, I thank you for taking me in.
I didn't let you in, Mallory says. We all did. What kind of man, she wonders, would leave his brother behind? She looks to Don, to Cheryl, to Olympia. Has Gary's story endeared him to those who voted not to let him in? Or has it justified their fears? Insanity fuss. Tom and Felix are asking Gary questions about his story. Jules pipes in, too. But Cheryl has left the room. And Don, who has something to say about everything, isn't speaking much. He just stares.
A divide, Mallory thinks, is growing.
Exactly when it began doesn't matter to her. It's visible now. Gary brought with him a briefcase, a story, and, somehow, a divide. 29. Mallory wakes with her eyes closed. It's not as difficult to do as it once was. Consciousness comes. The sounds, sensations, and smells of life. Sights, too. Mallory knows that even with your eyes closed, there is sight. She sees peaches, yellows, the colors of distant sunlight penetrating flesh. At the corners of her vision are grays. It sounds like she's outside. She feels cool open air on her face. Chapped lips, dry throat. When is the last time she drank? Her body feels okay, rested. There is a dull throbbing coming from somewhere to the left of her neck, her shoulder. She brings her right hand to her forehead. When her fingers touch her face, she understands they are wet and dirty. In fact, her whole back feels wet. Her shirt is drenched in water. A bird sings overhead. Eyes still closed, Mallory turns toward it. The children are breathing hard. It sounds like they are working on something. Are they drawing? Building? Playing? Mallory sits up. Boy? Her first thought sounds like a joke. An impossibility. A mistake. Then she realizes it's exactly what's happening. They're breathing hard because they're rowing. Boy! Mallory yells. Her voice sounds bad, like her throat is made of wood. Mommy! What is going on? The rowboat. The rowboat. The rowboat. You're on the river. You passed out. You passed out. Hooking her lame shoulder over the edge, she cups a handful of water and brings it to her mouth. Then she is on her knees, over the edge, scooping handfuls in quick succession. She is breathing hard. But the grays have gone away, and her body feels a little better. She turns to the children.
How long?
How long?
You fell asleep, Mommy,
the girl says.
You had bad dreams, the boy says.
You were crying.
Mallory's mind is moving too fast. Did she miss anything? How long? She yells again.
Not long, the boy says.
Are your blindfolds on? Speak.
Yes,
they say.
The boat got stuck,
the girl says.
Dear God,
Mallory thinks. Then she calms herself enough to ask,
How did we get unstuck?
She finds the girl's small body. She follows her arms to her hands. Then she reaches across the rowboat and feels for the boy.
They're each using one paddle. They're rowing together.
We did it, Mommy,
the girl says. Mallory is on her knees. She realizes she smells bad, like a bar, like a bathroom, like vomit.
We untangled us, the boy says.
Mallory is with him now. Her shaking hands are upon his.
I'm hurt, she says out loud.
What?
The boy asks.
I need you two to move back to where you were before Mommy fell asleep. Right now.
The children stop rowing. The girl presses against her as she goes to the back bench. Mallory helps her. Then Mallory is sitting on the middle bench again. Her shoulder is throbbing, but it's not as bad as it was before. She needed rest. She wasn't giving it to her body, so her body took it. In the fog of her waking mind, Mallory is growing colder, more frightened.
What if it happens again? Have they passed the point they are traveling to?
The paddles in her hands again. Mallory breathes deeply before rowing. Then she starts to cry. She cries because she passed out. She cries because a wolf attacked her. She cries for too many reasons to locate. But she knows part of it is because she's discovered that the children are capable of surviving, if only for a moment, on their own.
You've trained them well, she thinks.
The thought, often ugly, makes her proud.
Boy,
she says through her tears,
I need you to listen, okay? I am, Mommy. And you too, girl. I need you to do the same.
I am too.
Is it possible, Mallory thinks, that we're okay? Is it possible that you passed out and woke up and still everything is okay?
It doesn't feel true.
It doesn't go with the rules of the new world.
Something is out there on this river with them. Madmen, beasts, creatures. How much more sleep would have lured them all the way into the boat? Mercifully, she is rowing again. But what lurks feels closer now.
I'm so sorry,
she says, crying, rowing. Her legs are soaked with piss, water, blood, and vomit. But her body is rested. Somehow, Mallory thinks, despite the cruel laws of this unforgiving world, she's been delivered a break. The feeling of relief lasts the duration of one row. Then Mallory is alert and scared all over again. 30. Cheryl is upset. Mallory hears her talking to Felix in the room down the hall. The other housemates are downstairs. Gary has taken to sleeping in the dining room, despite the hardwood floors. Since his arrival 2 weeks ago, Don has warmed up to him greatly. Mallory doesn't know how she feels about that. He's probably with Gary now. But down the hall, Cheryl whispers hurriedly. She sounds scared. It feels like everybody is, more than usual. The mood in the house, once supported mightily by Tom's optimism, gets darker every day. Sometimes, Mallory thinks, the mood extends deeper than fear. That's how Cheryl sounds right now. Mallory considers joining them, perhaps even to comfort Cheryl, but decides against it. I do it every day, Felix, because I like to do it. It's my job, and the few minutes I step outside are precious to me. It reminds me that once I had a real job, one I woke up for, one I took pride in. Feeding the birds is the only thing I have that connects me to the life I used to live.
And it gives you a chance to be outside.
And it gives me a chance to be outside, yes. Cheryl tries to control her voice, then goes on. She is outside, she tells Felix, ready to feed the birds. She is feeling along the wall for the box. In her right hand are apple slices from a can in the cellar. The front door has closed behind her. Jules waits inside. Blindfolded, Cheryl walks slowly, using the house for balance. The bricks are coarse against her fingertips. Soon, they will give way to a portion of wood paneling from which a metal hook protrudes. This is where the birds hang. They are already cooing. They always do when she gets this close. Cheryl heartily volunteered to feed the birds when discussion of the chore came up. She's been doing it every day since. In a way, it feels like the birds are her own. She speaks to them, filling them in on trivial events from the house. Their sweet response calms her like music once did. She can gauge how close she is to the box, she tells Felix, by how loudly they sing. But this time, she hears something besides their coos. At the end of the front walk, she hears an abandoned step. It's the only way she can explain it to Felix. It sounds to her like someone was walking, was planning to walk farther, then suddenly stopped. Cheryl, always on high alert whenever she feeds the birds, is surprised to realize she is trembling. She says,
Is anybody there?
There is no answer. She thinks of returning to the front door. She'll tell the others she's too freaked out to do this today. Instead, she waits. And there is no further sound. In the box, the birds are active. She calls to them nervously.
Hey, hey, guys. Hey, hey.
The quiver in her voice scares her. Instinctively, she lowers her head and raises the hand holding the apples to protect her, as though something were about to touch her face. She takes a step, then another. Finally, she reaches the box. Sometimes, she tells Felix, the walk between the front door and the box is like floating in outer space. Anchorless. Today she feels impossibly far from land.
Hey, hey,
she says, opening the box's lid just enough to be able to drop a few of the apple slices. Normally she hears the pitter-patter of their tiny feet as they rush for the food. Today she does not.
Eat up, guys.
Aren't you hungry? She opens the lid the tiniest bit again and drops the remaining pieces inside. This, she tells Felix, is always her favorite part. When she closes the lid and presses her ear to the box, listening to their tiny bodies as they eat. But they do not start eating. Instead, they anxiously coo.
Hey, hey,
Cheryl says, trying to shake off the tremble in her voice.
Eat up, guys.
She takes her ear from the box, thinking her presence today is making them shy. As she does, she shrieks. Something has touched her shoulder. Spinning, blind, Cheryl waves her arms wildly. She touches nothing. She can't move her legs. She can't run inside. Something touched her shoulder, and she does not know what it was. The voices of the birds no longer sound sweet. They sound like what Tom wanted them to be. An alarm.
Who's there?
She worries someone will answer. She doesn't want someone to answer. She decides to yell. One of the housemates can come get her, pull her back to earth. But as she takes a step, she hears a leaf crushed beneath her shoe. Frantically, she tries to recall the first time she arrived at the house. She looked at it through the window of her car.
Was there a tree? Here by the front walk? Was there?
Maybe it was only a falling leaf that grazed her. It would be so easy to find out. If she could just open her eyes for a moment, she would see she was alone. She would see it was just a leaf, nothing more. But she can't. Shaking, she presses her back to the house and slowly slides toward the front door. Her head swivels left, then right, at the slightest sounds. A bird high in the sky. The rustling in a tree across the street. A small gust of warm wind. Sweating, she feels the brick at last, and hurriedly makes it to the door.
Jesus, Felix says. Do you really think it could have been a leaf?
She pauses. Mallory leans farther into the hall.
Yes, Cheryl suddenly says. I do. Playing it back? That's exactly what it was.
Mallory steps back into her bedroom and sits upon the bed. Felix's story about the well and what he heard out there. Victor barking at the blanketed windows. Cheryl with the birds. Is it possible, Mallory wonders, that the world out there and the things they hide from are closing in? 31. To Mallory, since the arrival of Gary, the house feels absolutely different, divided. It's a small change, but under these circumstances, any change is a big one. And it's Dawn who worries her the most. More often than not, when Tom, Jules, and Felix are talking in the living room, Dawn is in the dining room with Gary.
He's expressed a heavy interest in the story about the man who took down the drapes and unlocked the doors. While washing clothes in the kitchen sink, halfway through the second-to-last jug of detergent, Mallory listens to two conversations at once. While Tom and Jules are turning long-sleeved shirts into dog leashes, Gary is explaining to Don the way Frank thought. Always the way Frank thought. Never quite what Gary thinks himself.
"I don't think it's a matter of one man being better prepared than another," Gary is saying. "I think of it more like a 3D movie. At first, the audience thinks the objects are really coming at them. They hold their hands up for protection, but the intelligent ones, the ones who are very aware, know they were safe all along."
Don has come full circle with Gary. Mallory thinks she saw when it happened.
"Hey, I don't think that theory is any more cracked than ours," Don said to him once. "It's hard," Don says now, "because we don't get any new reports."
"Exactly."
Yes, Don has gone from voting against letting Gary in to being the one housemate who sits with him and talks, and talks, and talks. He's skeptical, Mallory thinks. That's his nature, and he's needed someone to talk to. That's all this means. He's different than you are. Don't you understand? But these thoughts, just as they aren't taking root. No matter how she perceives it, Gary and Don are talking about things like hysteria and the idea that the creatures can't cause harm to someone who is prepared to see them. Don, she knows, has long espoused a greater fear of man than creatures. Yet he closes his eyes when the front door opens and closes. He does not look out the window. He has never committed to the idea that the creatures cannot hurt us. Could someone like Gary convince him at last? She wants to talk to Tom about it. She wants to pull him aside and ask him to make them stop, or at least go and talk with them. Maybe his words will influence their conversation, make it sound safer. Yes. She wants to talk to Tom about Don. Division. With trepidation, she crosses the kitchen and looks into the living room. Tom and Felix are reading a map on the floor. They are measuring distances according to the map's mileage scale. Jules is teaching the dogs commands. Stop. Start again.
"We have to measure what is an average step for you," Felix says.
"What are you guys planning?" Mallory asks. Tom turns to her.
"Distance," he says. "How many of my steps are in a mile?"
Felix is using the measuring tape at Tom's feet.
"If I listen to music as I go," Tom says, "I could walk in rhythm with it. That way, the steps we measure in here would be close to the ones I take out there." "Like dancing," Felix says.
Mallory turns to see Olympia is now at the kitchen sink. She washes utensils. Mallory joins her and continues washing the clothes. After being confined to this house for almost 4 months, Olympia has lost a little of her shine. Her skin is pale, her eyes deeper set.
"Are you worried?"
Olympia suddenly asks.
"About what?" "About making it."
"Making what?"
"Surviving our deliveries."
Mallory wants to tell Olympia that it's going to be okay, but she struggles to locate the words. She is thinking about Don.
"I've always wanted a baby," Olympia says. "I was so excited when I found out. I felt like my life was complete, you know?"
This is not how Mallory felt, but she says yes, she knows.
"Oh, Mallory, who is going to deliver our babies?"
Mallory doesn't know. "Our housemates. I don't see..."
"But Tom's never done it before."
"No, but he was a father." Olympia stares at her hands, submerged in the bucket.
I'll tell you what, Mallory says facetiously. We'll deliver each other's.
Deliver each other's?
Olympia says, smiling at last.
Mallory, you're too much.
Gary enters the kitchen. He scoops a glass of water from a bucket on the counter. Then he scoops a second glass. Mallory knows it's for Don. As he exits, music suddenly comes from the living room. Mallory leans back so she can see in there. Tom holds the small battery-operated radio. It's one of George's cassette tapes. Felix, on his hands and knees, measures Tom's steps as he walks in rhythm to the song.
What are they doing?
Olympia asks. I think they have somewhere specific in mind to go, Mallory says. They're trying to come up with a better way of traveling outside. Mallory quietly steps to the dining room's entrance. Peering in, she sees Don and Gary, their backs to her, sitting in dining room chairs. They are speaking quietly. Again, she crosses the kitchen. As she enters the living room, Tom is smiling. He has a leash in each hand. The huskies are playing with them, wagging their tails. The discrepancy between the bright, progressive actions of those in the living room and the hushed, conspiratorial tones of those in the dining room is all Mallory can think about. She steps to the sink again and begins washing. Olympia is talking, but Mallory is thinking of something else. She leans forward and is able to see Gary's shoulder. Beyond him, propped against the wall, is the only item he brought in with him from the outside world. His briefcase. He showed them the contents when he entered the house. Don asked him to. But did she get a good look at them? Did any of the housemates?
And stop, Tom says.
Mallory turns to see the dogs and he are in the entranceway to the kitchen. The huskies both sit. Tom rewards them with raw meat. Mallory keeps washing. She is thinking of the briefcase. 32. She has known this was coming. How could she not? All the signs have been there since they returned with the dogs. Tom and Jules have been training them 10-12 hours a day, using the house, then the yard. Seeing eye dogs. The box of birds hanging outside works like an alarm, just like Tom said it would. The birds cooed when Gary arrived. They sing when Cheryl feeds them. So it was only a matter of time before Tom declared he was going to use the seeing eye dogs to enter the new world once again. But this time, it's worse. Because this time, he's going farther. They were gone 2 days for one block. When will we see them again if they go 3 miles? 3 miles. That's how far it is to Tom's house. That's where he wants to go. It's the only place I can be 100% sure of, he said. I've got supplies there. We need them. Band-aids, Neosporin, aspirin, bandages. Mallory's spirit rose with the mention of medicine. But Tom outside, and for that long, is too much for her to support.
Don't worry, Felix said that same night. We've mapped it out to a T. Tom and Jules are going to walk to the rhythm of a song. A single song. It's called Halfway to Paradise by a guy named Tony Light. They'll bring the radio and play it over and over as they follow the directions we've figured out. We know how many steps it will take for each direction, for every portion of the trip.
So you're planning on dancing there,
Gary said.
How nice.
Not dancing, Tom said aggressively. Walking to get help. Tom, Cheryl said, you can practice this all you want. But if your steps are a half an inch longer out there, you're going to be off. You'll get lost. And how the fuck are you going to get back then? You won't.
We will,
Tom said.
And it's not like we're helpless if we get lost,
Jules added.
We need the supplies. You know this better than most, Cheryl. You took stock last.
Yes, this day has been coming. But Mallory doesn't like it at all.
Tom,
she said, pulling him aside, just before he and Jules left this morning,
I don't think the house could stand it if you didn't come back.
We're going to come back.
I understand that you think you will, Mallory said. But I don't think you realize how much the house needs you.
Mallory, he said as Jules called that he was ready to go, the house needs all of us.
Tom.
Don't let the nerves get to you like they did last time. Instead, lean on the fact that we came back last time. We'll do it again. And this time, Mallory, act as a leader. Help them when they get scared.
Tom.
You need the medicine, Mallory.
Sterilization. You're close.
It was clear that Tom was on a path of his own, prepared to repeatedly risk his life in the name of advancing life in the house. Last time they came back with children's shoes, she reminded herself. And she reminds herself again of this, now. Now that Tom and Jules are gone, embarking on a 3-mile walk into the most dangerous landscape the world has known. They left this morning. Felix went over the map with them once more. Gary encouraged them. Olympia gave them a Petoskey stone she said had always been good luck for her. But Mallory did not say a word. As the front door closed for the second time on Tom, Mallory did not call to him. She did not hug him. She did not say goodbye. It pains her now, only hours after their exit. Yet the few words Tom spoke to her before leaving are working. Without him here, the house needs a guiding force, a person who can remain calm among so much anxiety, so much justifiable fear. But it's hard. The housemates are not in the mood for optimism. Cheryl points out that the chances of encountering a creature are obviously much greater on a 3-mile walk than they are over a 2-block circle. She reminds those still in the house that nobody knows how animals are affected. What will happen to Tom and Jules if the Huskies see something this time? Will they be eaten? Or worse? Cheryl isn't the only one espousing dark possibilities. Dawn is suggesting an alternate group prepare themselves to leave in the event Tom and Jules do not return.
We need more food, he says, whether they make it back or not.
Olympia says she has a headache. She says it means a big storm is coming. And a storm has to alter Felix's measurements when Tom and Jules are forced to find cover. Cheryl agrees. Don is heading into the cellar to take his own look at the stock, to find out exactly what they need and where to go to get it. Olympia is talking about lightning and being out in the open. Cheryl is debating with Felix about the map. She's saying maps don't mean anything anymore. Dawn is talking about sleeping arrangements. Olympia is describing a tornado from her youth. Cheryl and Felix are getting heated. Olympia sounds a little hysterical. Dawn is getting mad. Mallory, sick of the growing panic, speaks up at last.
Everybody, she says, we have things we could be doing, right here in this house. We need to prepare dinner. The shit bucket hasn't been brought out all day. The cellar could be arranged better than it is. Felix, you and I could check the yard for tools, something we might have missed, something we could use. Cheryl, you've got to feed the birds. Gary, Don, why not make phone calls? Call every combination of numbers. Who knows who you might reach?
Olympia, it'd be really helpful if you washed the bedding. We did it a week ago, but with as little as we wash ourselves in this place, it's the little things, like cleaner sheets, that make it bearable. The housemates look at Mallory like she's a stranger.
For a moment, she feels embarrassed for asserting herself.